A lot to get to tonight. It's Sunday night on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. If you missed last night's conversation about cursed towns, about land that seems to be, for whatever reason, to be uninhabitable, the book Dogtown was something we focused on last night, but it could have been a lot of different towns. Go back and catch that on Streamlink. Tonight might be a show you might want to bookmark as well. Charles Ostman, the historian of the future, always looking ahead at events that have already transpired in the future and are going to be part of our past at the same time. That's why we're living them in the present. We'll tell you more about that coming up in just a moment. A little bit of crypto news before we get going, and we'll start with that eerie Norway spiral video. If you missed that earlier in the week, Charles Ostman will follow up on his previous visit with George Norrie on that in just a minute. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Yesterday on my blog, I put up a link to the photo of the supposed Bigfoot capture that was done here in the mid-state Minnesota area, about 250 miles away from where I am. The photograph was taken by a motion-activated camera hung out in the woods by some sincere guys, one of whom I'd had a chance to interview on Friday. So I put that little interview up in the blog on Saturday night. And then tonight I've already got up some crypto news, and it starts with something that happened earlier in the week, too. That eerie Norway spiral video, if you missed it, I put the link up first thing on the blog, and it's all about science tonight. I'll just skim through this quickly because I want to get to Charles Ostman, the historian of the future, as fast as possible. But there are some interesting pieces tonight at physorg.com. A team led by Yale University researchers has used nanosensors to measure cancer biomarkers in whole blood. This Yale breakthrough means that appearing in December 13th in the publication Nature Nanotechnology, this could dramatically simplify the way physicians test for biomarkers of cancers and other diseases. Also, a detailed genome map of the giant panda completed by Chinese scientists have shown that the notoriously shy animal is genetically similar to the dog. Not so much to the bear, although bears and dogs, of course, share a common ancestor. The dog is much more the modern cousin for the panda. No big surprise to me. I have a Boston Terrier. They look like panda bears in reverse. Anyway, there's that story there on the blog, too. And if the following story is true, Cheech and Chong should be super geniuses. A synthetic chemical similar to the active ingredient in marijuana makes new cells grow in rat brains. That's a story we've got linked up on our webpage. What's more, in rats, this cell growth appears to be linked with reducing anxiety and depression. The results suggest that marijuana or its derivatives could actually be good for the brain. And by good for the brain, they mean that they gave rats high doses of this artificial pot, basically, twice a day for 10 days, and it increased their nerve cell formation by about 40%. Plus, when the rats who had received the cannabinoid were placed under stress, they showed fewer signs of anxiety and depression than rats who had not been given the treatment. Come to think of it, none of my pot-smoking friends in high school were depressed. Honestly, I can't think of one who was. They were late to everything, rather unfocused. They kind of spooked easy. Spent a lot of time musing about how we're all just tiny bacterial specks under the big yellow toenail of the universe, but they were never depressed. In fact, they're pretty smart. They probably all work for NASA. And there's an interesting story tonight on the NASA webpage, too. The meteor shower that's going on right now is worth catching. A new moon will keep skies dark for a display that scientists at the NASA.gov website say could top 140 meteors per hour. That's a ton. I just went through a meteor shower earlier, or late this summer, early fall, and it was beautiful. This peak is happening tonight. Watch the sky during the hours around local time, midnight for North Americans. This means Sunday night into Monday morning, which means roughly right now. So make sure if you go outside to watch the space show, bring the radio show with you. And in most of the country, you might want to bring an electric blanket, too. And if you go outside, keep an eye out for more of those eerie Norway spirals. Charles Osmond was on earlier this week talking about it with George Norrie, and I put the link up to the blog for people that missed the YouTube video of that. Good evening, Charles.
Good evening, indeed.
I wanted to run through your resume so that I could verify what of these are still true.
okay, fair enough.
You're on the management team of Fourth Venture, yes?
Actually, that did come. That's no longer the case, and I apologize if that bio was not updated. I apologize.
That's all right. You are still a senior fellow at the Institute for Global Futures?
That is true.
Okay. Chair of the Nanoelectronics and Photonics Forum of NanoSig?
NanoSig was disbanded about a year and a half, 2 years ago. So, again, I'm sorry about that.
Two things you're going to have to take up.
Okay,
senior consultant with Silicon Valley Nano Ventures?
Yes, I still am.
Okay. And on the advisory board of Legendary Pharmaceuticals?
Actually, that's kind of gone a different direction, but I'm still very much in contact with the founder, John Ferber, but I'm no longer on the board.
Okay. He's the active participant with the Millennium Project for Global Futures Studies Research of the American Council for the United Nations University.
Very much so. In fact, Jerry Glenn was actually on Coast to Coast a few weeks ago. He's the founder and CEO, and I very much appreciate the fact that George had him on. It was a very good show, and it's very compatible with actually what we talked about tonight.
Very good. And so I'd heard that you were going to be on, but I didn't catch your discussion with George about the Norway spiral. But it seems to me the timing of that was that you came on either just before the Russians confirmed that it was one of their rockets. Had they confirmed it yet when you came on with George earlier this week?
No, but I'm still not buying their explanation, and I would gladly, you know, sort of point out my alternative view. Yes, that is what they released officially. But what has not been released officially, by the way, are spectrographical analysis of what was up there in the atmosphere. And normally, if the rocket had, become disabled, you'd see spectral traces of absorption lines, really, of things like hydrazine and other well-known, standard rocket propellants. But nobody's released that data that I know of.
So the at first, though, the Russians denied that that was an out-of-control rocket fired from an area that typically they fire rockets from. So that part wasn't unusual.
Not unusual, although the direction it was traveling was kind of unusual. That's one little piece of that puzzle I might throw in there.
All right. And then, although if it had malfunctioned, do we really know what direction it was supposed to be heading in?
Well, you can't really say for certain. I mean, obviously, all the major superpowers that launch these things, including us and China, for that matter, will keep these things secret even after they're launched. But nonetheless, I mean, the Norwegians were told in advance that there'd be some kind of a test, and then this thing occurred.
And
we'll go with that.
I guess my question was, is if just because it ended up in if the trajectory of the rocket seemed out of the ordinary, wouldn't that be consistent with the idea that it was misfiring and they had lost control of it, though,
No, certainly there's a logic to that, but the alternative logic could be, and I'm just offering a suggestion, I'm not saying I have any hard proof, I'm just saying another way of looking at it would be if one of the other agendas was to launch a device that would then dispense some kind of material, like, for instance, barium or some other material that's often used for ionospheric experiments, that would be exactly what they would do. They would launch it, it would dispense the material in a large pattern, as we saw.
Right.
And to be illuminated possibly with a HARPA-like instrument or something else similar to actually see what the reaction would be. And we've done the same experiments ourselves. That's why when I saw this, the first thing I thought of was exactly that, because I've actually seen the very same experiments that we've done over in our part of the world.
Well, that's very interesting. So, but since then the Russians have confirmed, yes, in fact, that was one of our rockets. And okay, so, but let's go back to what you're saying. So we have done something like this where we have intentionally fired something that created a large area in the sky, which was in some way washed with a chemical that we wanted to test.
Correct. The idea was that can we affect the behavior of the ionosphere? Can we create either a hot spot and or can we change the RF oblido, that is the reflectivity or certain spectral ranges within certain reflective areas, to accommodate some kind of a larger project? And that, I mean, the range of things that HARP-like systems are used for is actually quite diverse. It's not just one thing. It's a whole variety of things.
What do you think this could have been that they fired up in the air? You mentioned barium earlier, but what is it that you think they would have done if it was similar to what we had done in the past?
One possible arena of research that's been well documented could be the potential of changing in some way the climatic sort of patterns of the Earth. In other words, if one wanted to, say, alter a jet stream or just create a hot spot for some other reason, that would be one way of doing it. The other thing is that you have to also realize that when the ionosphere and then, of course, the troposphere below it is illuminated with cosmic rays or solar wind particles from the sun, that causes a reaction with the elements that are in the atmosphere. A lot of people have been very interested in seeing if they can change that or in some way modify those reactions. So there's a variety of reasons why this could be done.
So what's possible, they sent something up and then they were measuring it. And what you'd like to see is if anybody else had done any independent measurements of the atmosphere in that area.
Correct.
While that spiral was appearing.
Correct.
Who would be the other people that would be able to do a measurement like that?
Well, anybody with the appropriate spectrographical equipment, which would be any number of observatories around the world. I am kind of surprised that there hasn't been. There may be data out there now. I just haven't seen it. I've been looking for it, and nobody's published anything that I know of. Certainly, we would have the equipment for that. And absolutely, if we have satellites looking at this area from above, we could get a very much more accurate read on what's there.
So we could do that sort of spectral analysis with satellites?
Certainly can.
Okay.
What you look for are absorption lines. You look for certain characteristics in the light that you either pass through or see reflected from that region.
Let's say worst case scenario, you're right in how you are suspicious that this was not just a misfire, but this was an intentional, this was a ruse, this was a subterfuge as they shot this rocket up and then they're doing some sort of experiment. What is that indicative of to you? What is it that you think the Russians then are up to? They're up around the Arctic Circle.
There's several things could be possible. One would be an experiment to see if they could cause any kind of jamming or blocking of mission-critical communications. In other words, if they could create sort of an opacity that would prevent our satellites from communicating in a certain kind of way. Another could be certainly in climate adjustment experiments, which is something that's been going on for quite some years. And then there's others which are more speculative, but those are the two that I would think would be most likely.
How would you see that this, what kind of impact would this have on us? I mean, let's just say this was a successful test.
Well, nothing directly, but it would indicate that they're involved in a program where this is part of their future strategic initiative. In other words, everybody involved in this kind of game is constantly testing new technology and seeing what the potential artifacts are. Not that the results right now would be of any consequence, but it just proves an experiment that would further the research along these lines.
Let's talk about your article that's in the current edition of the After Dark newsletter.
Sure.
As it informs this conversation about that which you believe is going on all above us. I would say all around us, but all above us. How could this inform that conversation?
Well, they could be related. And again, this is more speculative. I'll start with what I can certainly determine as being hard fact. In other words, things that have been seen by myself and others who are equipped with the same kind of apparatus and have been very reliable sources of this kind of information. On 9 occasions, I personally, along with several other witnesses on every occasion, have seen objects traveling what appears to be at very high altitude, at fairly high rates of speed. Usually these are in formations either in a delta or perhaps a diamond-like formation. They tend to be what looks to me like metallic or hard-edged, round or oval-shaped objects, and they perform what absolutely looks like some kind of controlled flight or maneuvers. On 2 occasions, these things made abrupt change of direction or just seemed to indicate things that would not normally be associated with typical aircraft or even high-performance aircraft. Unfortunately, the slides that I supplied don't seem to be functioning at the moment, but should they ever come to life, you'll see some pictures and perhaps
on the webpage, you mean?
Well, yes, I had uploaded a bunch of images to the web manager, and he's been trying desperately to get them to load, and I guess they're
okay
working with that right now.
But hang in there, Tim. Go ahead.
And Tim's been very, very nice. I don't want to discredit him. He's been trying his best to make this all work. But the basic idea is going. I met a guy named Ed Grizzly a couple of years ago.
I've had you both on the radio before.
Yes, he certainly did. And, I haven't talked to him in a long time, although he did call me tonight. We just had a brief chat. But he just said, hey, Charles, what do you think of this? And he brought out some Generation 3 military spec night vision system. And I have to point out, by the way, the last time you had me on the air, and this is why I made that little notation in the article, and I hope you can forgive this, because at the time you were suggesting that any kind of ordinary night vision equipment like you might find at a sporting goods store or something like this would be appropriate to look at this. And actually, that's not the case. You have to have either a Generation 3 or a Generation 4. And these are much more high resolution. And more importantly, they have a much broader spectrum range and a fantastically larger light gathering capacity to operate in these long wavelengths. And these are exactly the kind of equipment that's used by our military in Iraq and Afghanistan, and in some cases for law enforcement. And in fact, to even buy this kind of equipment, you actually have to prove that you're a U.S. citizen, and they make you fill out all kinds of forms. And it's quite a process, actually. So, I mean, these devices, you know, they range about $3,000 to $4,000, and they go up from there. So Ed happened to have a couple of these devices handy. We walked outside. We were at this, I believe, a UFO conference, even though I'm not a UFO guy at all. I just happened to be at this conference because some friends of mine were there. So we looked up in the sky, and I saw this formation of these things flying by. And I said, well, that's kind of strange. What is that? And we talked about it for a while, and it just seemed interesting. And then, of course, as you know, I went up to Northern California where he lives, and we spent some more time, and we saw some things up in the air. And I said, well, this is kind of fascinating. And since I had personally worked on some Star Wars-related projects a number of years ago and still have a lot of friends in the industry, it kind of told me that maybe there's something that we're testing here. There's some kind of a program going on. Now, there's a lot of other things happening in the political and sort of, I don't know what you might call it, the geopolitical and strategy world, which I might add as sort of additional information in the background. But just to stick with the hard facts at the moment, I became so intrigued by this that I then talked to some other friends of mine who also happen to have the same equipment. I know a lot of pilots, professional pilots, and they sometimes have the same kind of equipment. So on many occasions in several states, New Mexico, California, and then most recently in Hawaii, again, with different people, but at the same time with the same kind of equipment. Sure enough, you look in the sky, not all the time, of course, but at least on a few occasions, once again, you'd see these same objects flying about. So it just kind of suggested to me that there's something going on. There's some kind of a testing program or some kind of technology which is being developed for some future application. And if that would be the case, then that would kind of lead to the next question, which would be why and for what purpose and who's doing this. And that's kind of the context I was hoping to discuss tonight and to go further in this topic.
Well, I look forward to that. Since you brought up the article, I will just say I don't remember our conversation the way you describe it at all. Okay. And I didn't take to your description of it very kindly. So I wasn't going to say anything about it, but I actually I have a very different recollection of how that conversation went. And as you say, you laboriously tried to make a point with me. Yes. I will try not to be such a chimp for you tonight that you have to labor so hard to make your points.
I had a
much fonder recollection of that conversation, and I'll retain mine. I don't believe you quoted me accurately, but we'll leave it there for now and just say
I apologize profusely if that was misworded, because I was only trying to point out that I wanted to make it really clear that there was a sort of a slight discrepancy between what was described and what I was trying to emphasize was the caliber of equipment that was required. So if I misword that, I truly apologize, and I certainly meant no ill intent by that.
Well, I appreciate that. The article remains in the After Dark newsletter. I think, except for that rather self-serving digression, I will endorse the article because I think your information in there is very interesting, and I think the commitment to trying to see what other people can't see out there is very interesting. I do believe that we can't trust a foreign government like the Russians, who have a history of misinforming the world as to exactly what they're up to. And the fact that they denied it at first and then they confirmed it. And I think obviously they will not. We can't know yet what is behind the black velvet curtain of disinformation.
And also, I should point out that China has actually the most ambitious sort of space program and very aggressive space program that's mostly secret. And they also have by far the largest commitment to weather and climate modification experimentation, which is ongoing as we speak. What I was hoping to do, and I probably very badly misworded this, and I truly apologize because I've always enjoyed being on the air with you, is I was hoping to encourage you to actually acquire the equipment yourself. In other words, use the exact same equipment that we have used and then see if I wanted to encourage you to actually follow the exact same path we have to see if you see the same thing or are friends of yours.
Well, I have actually, and I've looked at many videos, and I take with a certain amount of pride the fact that I was the first person to broach this subject as a host on Coast to Coast.
Absolutely.
And And I think that there are whole chat rooms dedicated to what exactly is being seen in these night vision goggles. Even the G3 ones that you speak of, this next generation, even the Gen 4 versions, I think that these are wonderful pieces of machinery. Yeah. I don't know that I will agree that I'm seeing space battles in the sky.
I
we'll come back to that thought, and we'll explore more the mystery objects in the night sky that are out there tonight with Charles Ostman next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So what is it that they were firing up into the night sky from the Soviet Union? What are the Chinese up to? Charles Ostman, the historian of the future. We'll talk about that. If you've missed that Norway spiral piece, it's linked up at my blog at coasttocoastam.com. If you go to the webpage, just click onto the icon, it'll take you to that. And one way or another, you'll get there. It's very interesting. And you can see it in formation, which is part of what makes what Charles Ostman is saying so compelling. You can actually see it develop. But what is it that we're seeing? We'll get back to that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I think it's important then that we define some terms up front. I love the thought that with even sort of industrial grade night vision goggles, we would be able to see UFOs flying in formation and battling in the sky.
Well, hold on. First of all, you know, I'm actually reading now just at this moment. I just pulled it up on the computer. The paragraph, and it was a little strongly worded, and I truly apologize. Believe me, I feel terrible. I was not trying to throw a darkness on this subject at all. I was hoping to inspire the idea that if you wanted to actually do this yourself, and in fact, I even included a photograph of the exact piece of equipment that was used, and I'm very happy to provide all the references in terms of manufacturers and where you can go to maybe, I don't know, borrow them or rent them or something. But again, that was my purpose. I apologize. I would never want to cast dispersions on your program. That wasn't completely not where it's going with that at all, so I apologize.
I appreciate that. I'm glad you went back and reread it. I was just surprised that somehow I was singled out as some guy that that kept reciting and you had to laboriously talk to. So it makes me very reluctant to take my usual role with you, which is to be a devil's advocate and to try to get you to be sometimes clear when I think sometimes you can be kind of heady and big picture. And I try to bring you down a little
I feel very strongly that I don't know if you got this, but I sent a letter to you and also to Lisa that explains sort of the abstract I had in mind. And one of the things you've brought in the past, and I've always had a really strong respect for this, you've always asked the question, is there ever a time when members of the science community or the technology development community have ever said no, or that maybe we shouldn't push the button metaphorically, or that maybe we should stop and take a second look before we proceed? And I wanted to make a point that I think we might be at one of those impasses now. I have very severe trepidations about not just the things I've been looking at and what it might mean, but also this whole business about climate change and how we're being pushed very fast and very hard to this carbon credit / cap and trade thing, which I think is very, very hastily put together. And I think a lot of the data is quite questionable. And if you wanted to, we could certainly delve into that.
Oh, I think it is, too. And I think that I don't know if it's hastily put together, but it seems like there's no uniform. There's no standard by which all of the data can be measured. So I think you've got a lot of what seems like conflicting data. Even if it's conflicting in the same direction, then it should tell us that there's a problem here, and we can't we can't take the attitude that we have empirically determined one way or another exactly what's happening with the atmosphere. I do think there's an interesting debate on whether or not we're going through a normal warming Earth cycle, which would happen at any time in the Earth's past and will again in the future.
And there's a lot of data for that. Plus, the sunspot cycles have been very unusual, and that has a direct correlation on how it changed the reaction with both the troposphere and the ionosphere, which, of course, would directly affect jet streams. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the NOAA and NASA data, it will tell you that there is global climate change and warming, in fact, on all of the other planets that can be measured. This is quite interesting.
So that would seem like it's more of a universal warming as opposed to something that's happening because of chlorofluorocarbons or, you know, whatever.
The main criteria, and there's quite a variety. There's over 100 different chemicals that could actually change the temperature of the Earth. But just to tap on this just for a little bit, the idea that this is being narrowed down to specifically CO2 is kind of suspect. And forgive me if I can just delve into this just a little bit, because what got my attention was not just the data. I just happened to live down the road from the Space Sciences Lab, which is a very well, one of the top science labs of this type in the world, actually. And the person that used to rent the upper floor of my house here in Berkeley, I own this little house here, he actually is a scientist that works there. So we talk about this almost every night. This is a PhD tenured professor who specializes in solar physics. I mean, we've had these debates a lot, and I got to look at lots of charts and data, and they don't know what's going on. They know that the sun is acting oddly. They don't know why. It's not doing the normal thing it does for its typical 11-year cycle, but the problem is that they've only had a few cycles to measure in any accuracy because the instrumentation didn't exist going back, you know, a few decades ago. And trying to look at larger macro cycles of solar activity mapped against, you know, billions of years of the life cycle of the star, that's an extremely complex and difficult, if not impossible, statistical model to work with. So they're truly measuring things as they see them and trying to determine what it means as they're collecting the data. I mean, it's very much an open book. And if you wanted to talk, you know, climate science, I'm not a climatologist. My background's in materials, but I can certainly tell you from a materials perspective that a lot of the data that was collected came from temperature measurements where, you know, sometimes it was in a city, sometimes it was out in the rural areas. Sometimes these temperature measurements were made, you know, near airports and other, you know, hot spots. So there's a lot of discrepancy about exactly what is the temperature mapping correlating to the amount of CO2 versus other chemistries that are involved. And then, of course, you have a whole different set of criteria. I should point out that weather mapping, or I should say climatic modeling, is probably the most complex type of nonlinear chaotic system modeling that can exist. Yeah. It pushes the extreme outer limits of what can be done with computing. And the reason I know that is because years ago, when I was still working in the SDI world, I remember that back at the time, they were trying to simulate the effects of a nuclear blast using the best supercomputers of the day. And that was really very fringy stuff. They would try to do the best they could to simulate just one local event, you know, completely in a kind of isolated fashion. Even that was pushing the edge of computer science. And the problem with these models now is, sure, you can tweak the data to match a certain predetermined result, but that's part of the problem. The evidence is sort of coming to light that perhaps these models were more, how can I say this, designed to sort of fulfill a predetermined result as opposed to exploring all the variables that could result in different interpretations of what's being measured. So, I mean, there's a lot of open territory for debate, and where I get a little bit alarmed is trillions of dollars are at stake, not right. just in terms of lopsided trade agreements and so forth, but I should point out, in fact, I'll gladly give you some references to look at, the amount of behind this. I've been to several meetings, by the way, over the past couple of years.
You're about to go over your three digression rule.
Okay,
Charles.
Okay.
I like to give you three digressions of you want to point out, and then I begin to lose what the original thread was for where we start. And I know that you remember what it is, but I don't always remember what it is.
Last little summation is that the amount of money that's been put into different kinds of derivatives and other instruments of investment instruments based on carbon credits, based on the theoretical value of what these credits will eventually market for, you find the same Wall Street players that were sort of finagling with all these mortgage-backed securities, they're exactly the same people who are now playing around these carbon credit things. And that really raises a flag in my mind. You know, in other words, it's a little bit suspect. So I just want to, okay, so I'll stop right there. But
all right. Well, I think suffices to say that every year the weather people, whoever they all are, all of the government folks plus all of the meteorologists plus whomever, all get together and make predictions on the number of hurricanes we're going to have and how many of them will be severe.
Right.
And I think we're like 0-3. I think that has been,
right.
3 years in a row they've been saying, oh, this is the year it's going to get really bad, and
exactly.
It hasn't happened. So
in fact, we're having some of the coldest winters in the last 15 years right now. I mean, it's strange. I'm not saying they're all wrong, but I'm saying it's very open to interpretation.
But the coldest winter part, that, you know, as I understand it, the idea of global warming is just it's going to change the weather patterns in places.
Correct.
That had been a little cold are going to be very cold, and places that were a little hot are going to be very
right.
hot. So that
right.
part doesn't – I mean, I haven't quite figured out all of how that was supposed to work. I think we get varying narratives on that from the scientific community.
One piece of the puzzle is that when you clear-cut huge areas of forest, when you replace natural vegetation with, say, monocrops or cattle grazing, for instance, and when you modify major bodies of water, when you erect dams and change rivers and so forth, that has a tremendous effect on precipitation patterns and cloud formation, and that actually has more effect on temperature than the CO2 does. And that's a hard fact. You can research it yourself.
So, but to go back to where we started on this, and I know that this Norway spiral, this phenomenon in the sky. When it first appeared, a lot of people thought, well, that's just, I mean, it almost looked like a time portal that was opening up. I mean, it's that freaky looking.
Yeah.
And then, all right, so maybe it has a terrestrial explanation, and maybe that's a valid one or not. Yeah. Well, I guess one part piece that I just want to throw out is how was it that so many people happened to be able to tape it from the very beginning? It seemed like there's a lot of cell phones and a lot of other stuff that capture this event early on in the timeline of it unfolding. And I think, how do they know to point their cameras there? It just sort of seemed, I don't know why I can't get over that, but some of the most perfectly captured amateur video of an event, like, which was supposedly a spontaneous event.
Well, I will say, statistically, many people now have cameras that didn't have them, say, even 5 years ago. Even I can confess to that. And it's interesting because now when I'm out walking around or out at night visiting with a friend, I'm always thinking about what can I see in the sky or what can I get. There's a consciousness awareness that's perhaps more so than in the past. I might just throw that. And, of course, like I said, Norway was told in advance there would be some kind of experiment. The Russians did say something would be launched, and they had about an 8-hour notice. So
Get
that.
And maybe that's what happened. There was some people that knew to be out there to be looking, and they thought they were going to catch something very different, and it turned into that. So is it possible that we're looking at the further? Could these missiles? And you started to talk about China, and then I had to stop you because we got to the bottom of the hour, and I don't know what the Chinese are working on these days. But does this go back to your concerns about exactly what's happening in these objects overhead? Maybe what governments are shooting at that they won't tell us about?
Well, there's yes and no, thank you for sort of circling back to the square one. So I do my very best to stick with the track at hand. But first of all, let me just verify this so there's no misunderstanding. I have never seen, and I don't want to say this is not true, I'm just saying from what I have personally seen and from what others that I have been with have seen, we've never seen the battles in space. We've seen formations of objects. We've seen what I believe to be tight formations of some kind of controlled experimental craft, and I have some speculation about that. But I've never seen any beams or any rockets being shot or anything. I just saw these things flying around. I did see a couple occasions where they made interesting right-angle turns, that sort of thing. But I've never seen any kind of beam weaponry shot around. Now, I will say that I know that there are beam weapons that exist, and I can certainly elaborate on that, but I've never seen them fired in this context.
Okay. And so that might differ slightly from Ed Grimsley, with whom you spoke earlier, who has, you know, along with a couple other guys, they have, you know, videos of this, of these space battles, these supposed space battles that are taking place. You've never seen that.
I've never seen a space battle.
Okay. And whether or not that exists, that again, it comes down to what are we firing? What do you think that rocket could be, and what is it that the Chinese have, and what is it that we're firing at these days? Don't we have enough of this rocket technology right now to be doing any secret experiments? Implies what?
Well, the answer is what you just said. Rockets are antiquated. They're the Rube Goldberg. They're the rowboat of how to get around in space. And I'm going to propose to you that we're two squares ahead of that. And I think that the Russians are somewhat in the same vein of research, although they weren't funded as well as we were. And now that they have Chinese funding to work with, I think there's a collaboration on their side, and we're trying to match or exceed that collaboration.
Hmm. Okay. So if we're in the rowboat, what's coming down the river?
Okay. I imagine I'm going to try and make an analogy and see if this works. And I have a clumsy metaphor on my part. Imagine back in the days when the Spanish Armada and the Brits were facing each other. I think it was near 1560, if I remember correctly. And, you know, here you had the largest, most well-equipped navies in the planet with the best-equipped seamen and specialists that knew how to fight in the open ocean battles. Imagine if all of a sudden a nuclear-powered submarine popped up out of the water and launched a missile, or perhaps an aircraft carrier suddenly appeared with a full complement of jets. Nobody could explain what they're looking at. It would be that far ahead that it would be incomprehensible. That's kind of where this is going. In other words, people think in terms of rockets. They think in terms of propellants. They think in terms perhaps of scramjets or other ultra-high altitude jets. And I'm so sorry that the site that Coast to Coast can't display the pictures because I had a picture of one of these scramjets on there. But the whole point is that I think we're beyond that. I'm going to speculate that we're actually well into the gravity manipulation realm. And this has been a ongoing area of research for many, many years. The Russians were doing it. We were doing it, but in very, you know, in limited ways in lab experiments, you know, on the ground. We may have progressed far beyond that. And if there were a way to connect the dots from a sort of a geopolitical perspective and then compare that to what's being seen and the kinds of experiments that are going on in various labs that I do know about, it would kind of point in that direction. I would suggest to you that some of the UFOs that people have been seeing, maybe the Phoenix lights and maybe some of these other really dramatic scenes, may have been, in fact, some artifact of those kinds of experiments being conducted. And in a way, it's a way of, it's a tit for tat. We show what we have and they show what they have. And we kind of have this kind of a Cold War, almost like battle going on, not with guns or bullets, but I mean,
right,
just demonstrating that, okay, I have one of these. Well, I have one of these too. Now, you remember, of course, when the Chinese shot down one of their old weather satellites, and then, of course, shortly thereafter, we shot down one of ours, you know, et cetera. So we're kind of
right,
playing this tit-for-tat game, and I think that's where things are going.
Let's put aside the phallic implications of us trying to show each other how big our rockets are.
I didn't quite mean it that way.
No, but I think it is. I mean, I think it may come that way. Yeah. What kind of technology are we talking about? I mean, this is over my pay grade, so I don't know what do you mean when you're talking about these types of gravity rockets?
There's several different variations, and I won't bore you with a bunch of the physics, but the most common or basic version would be the idea of a gravity well on demand. And what that means is a gravity well, any object with a rest mass above zero, the tiniest particle to the largest planet, does pull time space around it. It contracts inward to the center of mass. It's a very weak force, but if you can concentrate enough apparent mass at a given point in time, and that's kind of the trick here, then you can create what looks like a gravity well. And the theory is instead of pushing something with a propellant, like a rocket burning some kind of fuel, you're creating a sort of a well in front of the thing, and it sort of falls towards this imaginary or temporarily contrived gravity well. So the theory is if you could create a system which could project a gravity well, even just a little bit in front of the craft in question, it would be constantly pulling towards it. And if you could do that, then you would create a bubble around the craft, which would make it inert or relatively inert to the forces of gravity that are usually felt. You know, when you're flying around in a typical jet and you suddenly pull into a sharp maneuver, you feel these G-forces because you're counteracting the gravitational force of the planet or the body around you. Whereas if you're creating an artificially contrived gravity well, not only do you have a way to fall towards a perpetual object in a sense, but you also are encapsulating yourself away from the effects of the gravity around you. So it buys you several things at once. And then, just to underline this, at the same time, you might also have the capacity to bend light around the object because light, of course, travels through this time-space medium called gravity. Now,
right,
what's kind of fascinating is I've actually talked to several people who have been working on a light-bending project, and some of it's classified, so I'll be a little fuzzy, but I can tell you at least that in certain wavelengths, it has been shown in a lab that this is possible. So if you add up the pieces of the puzzle that says light-bending experiments are ongoing, gravity wells are well understood, and the missing piece of this puzzle would be how would you build one of these things, and there's several designs that I've seen examples of that could point in this direction. So, I mean, I can't say conclusively, but I can say that the evidence kind of looks that way. Now, I'll put it that way.
All right. And you get this kind of information from whom? Can you talk about that?
Yes, a little bit. I no longer have any kind of clearance. And also, I should point out, I would never want to jeopardize security. I mean, I have no intent at all to undermine our security or to interfere with anyone else's. Most of this is publicly available if you know where to look for it. A lot of it's buried in very technical academic papers and that sort of thing. But piece by piece, bit by bit, you see little experiments that kind of say, oh, they've got this far with such and such. There's a couple of examples I'll throw out there. Several years ago, you may recall when Boeing actually published in their own in-house trade paper, they said, yes, we've acquired some of the former Soviet scientists who are doing exactly what I'm just talking about, and we're looking into developing, you know, some experiments. And then all of a sudden, they just said, oh, well, actually, we're not going to do that. And we're sort of, they didn't talk about it. They published two articles, and then it suddenly disappeared. Well, what that tells me is that actually, they're of course, they're doing it, and they decided because it was interesting enough, they're not going to go dark with it. And that's usually how these things work. You get a certain nibble, enough evidence to show it's kind of interesting, and if it gets the attention of DARPA and whoever else might be funding these things,
right,
and of course, it goes dark, and that's exactly what I saw in those previous articles.
I did a show on DARPA a couple of months ago with that new book out about the best, most definitive book on DARPA.
Oh, that's right, the mad scientist guys. I
love that. Yeah, that was really great. That was really, really interesting.
What is interesting?
I have you ever gotten any DARPA funding yourself?
I have worked on projects that were DARPA funded, yes. And this goes back to the early 80s. So I should point that out. But the procedure works is the following way. And back.
Okay, well, hang on to that procedure. I'll come right back to it. It's Charles Ostman. We'll get another hour with Charles coming up, and then we'll let some open lines rip for the last couple of hours of the show, too, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.